Accession number 30025, reel 5.
Checking a nicky out until, but there. No, it was good. But I said, going back to the team, yeah, we lived in each other's pockets all the time, so you had to make sure you got on with it. We had upsets, like I said before. You did fall out with somebody very, very shortly, very, very briefly, because you'd be relying on the next day to be alongside you. You couldn't have an ongoing disagreement. You'd have to sort it out immediately enough. And if I knew there was anybody having a bit of a upset with each other, I'd make sure I'd sort it out, because there's no way I could have it in the aircraft. And they knew that. I mean, I had some disagreements with people with various things. But no.
Did you have any mascots or superstitions or anything like that?
Mascots, well, we used to have different ones every year. We had, what do you call the chip thing? What do you call them? Flat Eric.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Flat Eric. We used to have, we had one from one of the fairgrounds, and we used to have them in the aircraft, sticking in the aircraft, and put them in the left-hand seat of the Gazelle. And I'd like one show we went to, and they used to have these, you know, these, and get so many numbers, and you can get a great big Taz, about yay big, or all the Goofy and all them, and what's the other dog? Anyway, we'd all have all these. In the Gazelles, we had, every one of us had one of these big furry things stuck in there as left hand seat, which was fantastic, because people used to think it was brilliant. We'd land on and they'd just see sort of Taz in it, or Goofy or Mickey Mouse and all the rest of it in the left hand seat. It backfired a bit, because we had a photograph taken at the display and they could see all these, so we got a bit of a talking to.
Really?
We couldn't display with them. We could fly with them to displays or fly away from displays. We couldn't actually display with them in the aircraft, because the hierarchy just thought it was a bit naughty. So.
What a shame.
Yeah, I know. But no, it was good. You should enjoy it.
And any superstitions or any?
No,
good,
I mean,
luck rituals.
No, the old break a leg would always, we always called break a leg as we went out to the aircraft. I would always, my last parting words, as we sort of, because the dirt dive was the last thing you did before you went to your aircraft. You didn't do a dirt dive and then go off and have a cup of tea, or, you know, do something else. Your aircraft signed for, everything would be signed for, everything would be ready for display, and the last few minutes before display would be dirt dive. We'd go all the way through it, standing after the dirt dive, and say, right, any problems? Right, and I would say, think wind. The wind's a big effect on our display. If it's coming the wrong direction, you have to obviously kick off for it and all the rest of it. So I would say, think wind, break a leg, keep safe. That's my last three words every time, and then walk away. Then we go straight to the aircraft, get up and go. Every time we came back in, it was get together, debrief it, and then off for a beer.
After that.
Yeah, but no, I enjoyed it. I actually ended up enjoying the meals.
So, why did you choose to leave?
The army.
Well, out of the Blue Eagles.
Well, no, the Eagles I did for 3 years, which is unusual. You normally do a couple of seasons. Most people only do one season, but to get two is good. To do three is even fantastic. And I did 3 years, and I loved every minute of it. And the reason I left is because in December 2003 I actually left the army, so that was my last season with the Eagles. Yeah, it was fantastic, and just a nice year, final year for me to leave the army, and be the team leader, and the only team leader non-instructor, which was a good feather on my cap. I enjoyed it, but yeah, I left the army in December 2003.
I'm just trying to remember what we talked about last time, and whether, just before we talk about what happens next, I'm just trying to remember, did we get a sort of a thumbnail sketch of the Lynx and its characteristics? I think we might not have done, because we talked about gazelles, I think.
No, we did, yeah, we spoke about, we did speak about them fully.
We have, okay, yeah. Good, all right, we're done. Yeah. Just wanted to double check. Okay, so in that case, what comes next?
Well, 2003, I decided to leave the military. There were several reasons for it. I was coming up to the big sort of five war pending in about a year or so of time. Older man now, 53 next month. So that's 2007, so we're back 3 years. Yeah, I was sort of 48-ish, 49. and I decided then to get a job in CivvyStream. I initially took a job with at Middle Wallop, which I was the maintenance test pilot for FBH flying the Lynx and Gazelle, which was fantastic for me because I was teaching the new Lynx display pilot for 2004 and 2005 as a civilian without an instructor, and it was classed as skills transfer. So I was transferring my fantastic skills onto the new pilot because I wasn't an instructor, so I couldn't be seen to be teaching aerobatics, which is skill transfer, which is great.
What was that like?
It was great because I would just take out the new guy and say, right, this is what we're going to do, and I'd go and throw these links around, because the first thing would be to brief everything we're going to do and demonstrate, and then I would go out with him in the left hand seat and I'd just put these links through all the manoeuvres that I could do. And I just loved it. The problem is there was no pressure on me whatsoever. I wasn't there to instruct it. I wasn't there to display it to anybody. I was just going to go out and do all these manoeuvres and show this guy how they were done. And the good thing about it is, because normally all over the airfield at Middle Wallop, say, right, we're going to do Lynx display, we're going to be on for 11:30 till 12 o'clock. So all the airfield will be mine, nobody else's. I had no pressures of timings. I had no pressures of turning on a spot in order to crowd centre. I would just have to do the manoeuvres, and they were just perfect, and they felt beautiful manoeuvres because I had no pressure on me. All I wanted to do was show this guy what this aircraft could do, and without sort of, oh, I'm going to be there for this second and all this, and it was just like, I'm going to show you a loop, I'm going to show you this, I'm going to show that, and it was just nice. Into the manoeuvres, out the manoeuvres, and it was fantastic, and I thought, brilliant. That's all I did. Once I taught him manoeuvres, after 3 or 4 weeks, he was then converted onto the manoeuvres, easy to crack on with his left hand seat. And then every now and then they would come up and say, oh, I'm not getting this loop right, I'm not getting this right. And I'd say, why are you doing this, doing that? Okay. And I'd go up with him again for a quick 10 minutes or so, put him right on whatever he was doing wrong. And that was fantastic for 2004 and 2005. I did the same thing.
So you're still quite heavily involved in the team, really?
Oh, yeah, I was well involved. And I was invited to more shows you can shake a stick at. But no, it was good.
Is there a sort of kind of a circuit of shows? How many shows would you do would they be doing in a season?
Oh, I can't remember what we did in the first year. The first year we did, lost count. But what happens is the civilian people, they put in their bids for the Eagles to go to their displays throughout Europe and UK. They go into display committee, which is to do with the hierarchy in the headquarters. They then select which ones they go to. And it could be, you know, it could be very, very busy, it could be very slack, and it just depends on which ones they chose. And that's how it was. So would you say, right, this is the shows you're going to, we then get the whole list of them, and then we'd work out how we're going to do it and all the rest of it.
So in a busy year?
Well, we did 40-odd in year one, which was a nightmare. Every weekend, we did a display from April through to October. Did it every single weekend. We did a display somewhere. We did a lot midweek. And just any of the, whether it's women. Fair enough, we could do three air shows in one weekend. We used to do like Southend and Biggin Hill were on at the same time. We could never understand that. Both in the south of England, but both shows were on at the same time. So we did the display at Southend for Sing in the Morning. Flew down to Biggin Hill, did one down there. Flew back to Southend, or waited down at Biggin Hill, did a second display for them, because we wanted to do obviously two, and then back up to Southend and do a display there. So we did four displays in two locations. And I remember we did Rockingham. Yeah, went to Rockingham, the big driving circuit. Lowestoft. The two. All in the same day. It was just a nightmare. Because to race from one side of the country to the other is not easy anyway, because we did lower stuff. We might do one at Shawbury up in near Shrewsbury, so we're doing one there. So we did that, we did the Rockingham in the middle en route, and it was just a nightmare, you know. So no, we could be doing several locations at one weekend. We did over some like 80 odd displays, nearly 100 displays, but 14 venues, you know, and it's just a nightmare. So it was quite busy. And we'd take it out here. I mean, some nights you'd finish, you'd have a beer and something to eat, and you'd hit the sack, and that was it. You were out until the next morning because you were just so mentally destroyed, really. But anyway.
So it worked, but just getting to transfer your skills wasn't quite so tiring.
Oh no, transferring skills, I enjoyed that. It was just a case of, I say without any pressures on me, because I didn't have to meet any timings or whatever. It was just showing the guy what he needed to do and then correct him if he even needed any corrections. And then I say as the season went on, they'd come and ask me for a little bit of advice and then do that for them. And I just loved it. But then I was still with the military. I've been with the military since 1969. It's now 2005. So it's 7 years? 36 years. I did 34 in the army. I then was thinking, I've always wanted to fly air ambulance. And this was one of my sort of thoughts years ago, to fly an air ambulance.
Why was that?
I just think they do such a splendid job throughout the country. I mean, I saw an ambulance land years ago, middle of a motorway, pick somebody up and off he went, and it was just, I thought, yeah. There's no way you could get an ambulance down to this incident in the middle of the motorway, because they blocked up the motorway lanes. Every lane was blocked, the hard shoulder was blocked, so they couldn't get ambulance down to it, they couldn't get fire engines down to it. Paramedics turned up in this air ambulance right in the middle of the motorway, landed on, sorted this person out, obviously very ill, and took him away. Now you couldn't do that without the fact that, you know, they had the air ambulance. I thought it was fantastic. And I thought, oh yeah, that's something I wanted to do. But saying that, at the same time, I was still in the military and I wanted a full career. So it was one of the things I put on hold. And then in 2005, I then decided I've got to break away from the military eventually. I knew it was going to be difficult for me, but
well, it's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, because I mean, even as a civilian, I was working for them, and it was just nice. But I had to break away eventually, and I looked around the country and put a few feelers out for jobs. I didn't actually apply for any jobs at that stage. I just looked around, and I heard that Stirling Aviation, which is at Norwich here, were looking for a pilot, and they obviously had the air ambulance contract with East Anglian Air Ambulance. So I initially did a bit of a phone call rather than a CV, explained to the managing director who I was, what I did, would you like to see my CV, and I was interested in the air ambulance rather than anything else. They said, yeah, come down and have a word. So I sent them my CV. I was invited up to have a chat with them, which I did. And I was offered a job on the spot, which was fantastic. I was also told I wouldn't just be primarily doing the air ambulance, it would be other roles, but my main thing would be air ambulance. And I was well chuffed. Started in the air ambulance role February 2006. I've been now for 14 months, 15 months, and loved it.
Can you tell me a bit about the air ambulance organisation? How is it structured?
Well, the East Anglian Air Ambulance obviously is a charity, which is a bit annoying because there's no government sponsorship for it. So the majority, I think there's 28, I think, in the country, majority are all charity. No sponsorship whatsoever. There's only a couple sponsored, which is in Scotland, because of the terrain and where they're located, and in Wales there's government sponsorship for them. The rest of them are purely charity, and the same as East Anglian Air Ambulance here in Norwich. They do a fantastic job. They support three counties, which is obviously Cambridge, Suffolk and Norfolk. They've got all their representatives in the various counties raising money, and they need in excess of about £3 million a year they are raising, and it's purely to keep the air ambulance going. So they do a fantastic job. It's annoying that the people have got to pay for their own ambulance, really, and that's why I personally believe they should be sponsored by the government or the lottery. Lottery, in my opinion, and it's only my opinion, wastes a lot of money on some silly little schemes and projects, and I reckon the next time the government turn around and say who's going to take on the lottery, they should be told that you must put £1 million £1 million every week to the charities for the air ambulance throughout the country. £1 million wouldn't be missed a week. Wouldn't be missed from how much money they take in. And if you work that out, not 28, so that £2 million a year per charity almost. Pretty fantastic.
So how do they go about raising money?
And do a little begging. No, they have all sorts of events they go to. All the main county shows, all the main counties sports facilities do their own events for us. The golfing do events for us. The charities themselves obviously get out in the cities and set up their stalls and obviously do book of collections. We've got a lot of people. Even though they've got nothing to do with the charity, just purely the fact that they want to raise money for the charity. They do golfing events, they do fishing events, they do running events, they do parachuting events, just to raise money for the charity. Some of them have had personal involvement with family, and we've actually done something for them. A lot of the people just want to contribute towards the air ambulance because they know that the importance of having the air ambulance, and I think that's great. But we do get a lot of people who have had them, obviously, personal contact with us, or family, or friends, may have saved a life, may not have saved a life, but they want to put in a little bit to the charity, which is fantastic. And I take my hat to all of them. And when I meet people on the ground, when I'm out on my job, and I've always got time to speak to them because I think you're paying for this, you know. And they always thank me or thank the paramedics. Oh, you're doing a splendid job. And I always turn around to them and say, well, I wouldn't be doing this splendid job if it wasn't for you people putting your hands in your pocket. And that's how I look at it. This is your ambulance, you're paying for it, and we will use it to the best of our ability to give you a good service. And it is, they've got their own pocket. It's a bit annoying, really. But
so, tell me what happens. You get the job, and what happens? Can you remember your first day?
No, I can't remember the first day, no. I've been, obviously, now about 15 months into it. I'll just run you through a typical day. Obviously, at the moment we start off at 7:30 in the morning is when I start my shift, and we're a 10-hour shift. And this is governed by the CAA. It's not done by the charity. It's not governed by the company I work for, Stirling Aviation. It's governed by the CAA. And we're only allowed to do so many hours per day, and with so many hours rest. So if I do a 10-hour shift, I've got to have a 12-hour break. That's how they work it out. If I go over the 10 hours because if I'm on a job or whatever, then we've got to put a discretionary report in, etc. It just goes on and on. If they say, for instance, went to a 12-hour shift, which we could do, and the CAA approve it, I could only do a maximum of 4 days on duty, and then I've got to have 4 days off. So it's a shift system all the time. That means I couldn't be used for any other work that my company want me to work for or do. It's all CAA flying hours on the safety side of it, and also for everybody else. So that's our main thing. We've gone by the CAA on hours we can fly. But a typical day for me, I start at 7:30, get all my MET together, my NOTAMs together, which is notification of anything that's happening within the counties I'm working. NOTAM stands for notification to airmen of anything that's going on, which is flying displays, balloons, gliding displays, parachuting, fast jets, anything within the three counties I need to know about, and what time they're doing it and what height they're working at and whatever, so I can avoid it or know to speak to if I'm going to go anywhere near them. That's on the NOTAM side. Obviously we need the weather for the day, so we know what we expect. If we're going to have bad weather, good weather, windy, rainy, you name it. We also need to make sure the aircraft is fully serviceable. We haven't got any defects on it. All the equipment's ready to rock and roll in it. We've got full fuel. So on the technical side, the aircraft ready to go, all the radios are working, and then we do a brief around about 10 to 8, once we've got all bits and pieces together, and we have either a doctor and one paramedic or two paramedics depending on the crew that day. We're a bit short of doctors. We have half a dozen doctors at the moment, so they can't do every day, so we have two paramedics on one day, a doctor and a paramedic, and obviously myself, and that's our crew. We brief on everything, the NOTAMs and the MET. They then make sure we've got any PR on that day. And then round about 8:30, 9 o'clock, we'll move down to Honington, which is just south of Thetford. We which is our forward mountain base where we'll position ourselves for the day, which gives us the best response time to the three counties, almost central to the three counties, and that's where we get passed from the various ambulance agencies.
So where do you wait? Were you waiting for a call?
Down at Honington.
But do you have is there a room?
Oh, we've got a little crew room. The Royal Air Force at Honington have given us a little room in the fire station, which is nice. It's got all our radios in there, with a TV, normal coffee making machine, facilities, water facilities, computers for various bits and pieces. And we sit down there, and if we get a shout, we'll respond to it anywhere in the three counties. We're normally averaging about 4 or 5 shouts a day with the ambulance, air ambulance, and it could be anything. Some could be bad, could be good, could be reasonable, could be deaths. Just depends. But we get called and they'll ask us to go through whatever job it is. We'll respond as fast as possible, bearing in mind my job is to get the paramedic and the doctor or the paramedics to a location as quickly as possible and as safely as possible. The other way around, as safely as possible and as quickly as possible. A paramedic up front with me, or a doctor, who will assist in navigation to the scene. And then once we get to a scene, we then assess a landing site as close as we possibly can.
So what are the criteria for, what are you looking for when you're looking for a landing site?
First of all, we're looking to find out exactly where the location of the patient is, which can become a nightmare because the controller have been given lack of information on the call takers, or the information given by the person that's phoning in is inaccurate, he's in the wrong road, he's in the wrong street, he's south of the village, not north of the village, and you know, because they haven't got a Scoobies, a lot of people. So whatever information control's been given, they pass to us. Some of it's very vague, some of it's very detailed, it just depends. So our primary task as soon as we arrive is locate where the patient is, on the ground, in the town, in the field, in the woods, whatever. We've got to locate where the patient is. We will then quickly, it's also very quickly because you're thinking on your feet now, is find the closest location I can land safely without disruption to animals, people, buildings, endangering the aircraft, endangering myself, endangering everybody else around. So I've got to find an area which is obviously large enough for me to land in. The surface is good enough for me to land in. It's not sloped, it's not lumpy, it's not brand new tar road or something like that. You know, everything's got to be checked on that. The surrounds of the landing site's got to be selected quickly, because what you don't want to do is go in and start blowing rubbish around. There's obviously wires, there's a main problem, high tension wires, high tension cables. That's one of our big no-nos for, obviously, aircraft. The shape of the actual landing area is taken into consideration. It's good to obviously get in and get out. You may be able to land there, but have you got the lift capability to lift off with an extra person on board? That's another thing we've got to consider. Because I might turn up full of fuel. I've got two heavy paramedics, myself. So I might be landing at that field or that location just with the power in hand. I can land. But if I put an extra person of 100 kilograms, I can't take off. So you've got to consider that as well.
So how do you handle that situation?
Well, we put a standard fuel load in, and what happens is, as I'm flying, that fuel, obviously the fuel's disappearing. So I'm coming down, which is better for me, because the lighter I get, the better I'm going to have for performance. With the the Bulka 105, the old helicopter, that was critical because it's got less lift, it's got less power, and you couldn't do a lot of lifts. You couldn't do because you needed to come out vertically. Now they didn't have the power to do it. You'd be overdoing the engines. With the new one, we've got lots of power in hand. It's easy for me to do calculations. So as your fuel's going off, that's your weight coming down. So I will write on my knee pad that as long as I've got 380 kilograms of fuel on board, I can do any landing sort of thing. That's how it'll be. So what I'm doing is checking that all the time. I'm going in, checking that. And if everything's all well, I can get in here, but I can't get out, fine. What I'll do is I'll drop the paramedics in, because they're close, and I'll just say to them, I'm going to relocate, because they know then I can't get out of that landing site with extra bods on board. So what I'll do is I'll land in, they'll jump out with their kit, they'll run to the casualty, I'll take off and find another suitable as close as possible that I can get in and out of with extra weight if necessary. It's mainly on the old aircraft on the 105, but the new 117, it normally doesn't have a problem for us because we've got lots and lots of power in hand and we've got a lot more lift capability than that aircraft. But the consideration you've got to do all the time, calculations, it's thinking on your feet, obviously safety primary straight away, and the adrenaline's going because you're thinking of the patient. You want to get the guys on the ground as quick as possible, so you can't waste time flying round and round and round looking for a suitable, you know, area. And like I say, if you have, quick decision, I'll land there, I'll take off and reposition. And that's what I've done a good few times. What you're trying to do also at the same time is thinking of access for your stretcher, access for extracting the patient anyway. So not, you might be able to have a great big field in the world to land in, but you've got a 10-foot fence all around it, so you've got to get access to a gate, you know, if you can. Surface, because you try and get your stretcher across that. We don't want people trundling for 200 or 300 meters carrying a patient on a stretcher.
So it's a stretcher, and we're a stretcher, just carried stretcher.
No, we've got on the 117, the new aircraft. Ours is a wheeled one. It comes out, the wheels drop down, and we can wheel it. If we haven't got access, they'll put them on a board and then put them onto the stretcher and put them in the aircraft. Primarily, I'm trying to get good access for the stretcher so we can wheel the stretcher out to the patient. If not, still access for them to bring him in on a board and put him on our stretcher. So that's another thing that's gone through your mind. It's not something that you've got, you know, hours and minutes. You've got seconds to make these decisions. You're thinking about it all the time as soon as you're coming in, and you're saying, right, that's where the patient is. Right, the nearest location is there. What's the problem for that? It's got wires across there. It's got big trees. It's got that. It's got loose articles down there. There's scaffolding. There's a load of debris to one side. I can't go in there. It's going to blow. So you're out the question straight away. You know, then you get the next closest one to them. And I mean, I've gone in. I thought, oh, that's no big lawn there. I'll go in there. There's no wires. There's nothing. This and that. You're in there. Somebody's front garden. And you just think, okay, it's not a problem. I mean, the people are very, very good about it. I mean, you just say, sorry, I'm there, Amherst, and they say, yeah, no problem. I've landed on bowling greens. They're not too happy, but that's the way it goes. It's a nice landing spot. Nice and flat. Because most bowling greens are flat until I get them there. But no, it helps nothing. Just roll a ball down the groove I've left for them, and they can just go straight to the target.
Make it easier.
Yeah, it's easier. Instead of all that curving, so just go straight on that line. But no, it's obviously, and I keep saying that, safety. It is safety. Safety for the aircraft, safety for me, safety for the crew, safety for the patient. It's all safety. But we need to get as close as we can. We don't want people running up miles and miles of road. Sometimes it's necessary that we have to land a kilometre away because there's no access, middle of a town, whatever, and we can get secondary transfer. We'll use a grand ambulance, or we use a 4x4 or somebody else to help us with that. And I mean, they'll take it to us, bearing in mind if we know it's better for us to take them in the helicopter to a hospital than to put them on the ground ambulance, then yeah, we'll do a secondary transfer, they'll transfer to us and we'll take them from there. So we have landed, you know, a good kilometre away from a target, because we were nowhere else to land.
So you land?
Yeah.
On the bowling green. Then what happens next?
Well, the paramedics, as soon as I land on, and the aircraft's safe, there's no ABFNs around, they'll deploy. I'll get the paramedics to go, and then I'll close down